From Revolver, Tomorrow Never Knows, The Beatles, Contemplating Consciousness and the Infinite. Perfect segue and introduction to our guest and subject for the rest of this evening. There's a quotation in Jeffrey Kripal's new book. It goes like this. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. It's just the sort of mind-bending brain twisters that upends our way of thinking, turns our beliefs on their heads, that is so replete in this book, Comparing Religions, tying together the kinds of experiences and encounters that some might consider religious or spiritual, others might call supernatural or paranormal or just weird. Are they all manifestations of the same things? And what do they tell us about why we're here and what comes next? Big questions, folks, as big as they get. Dr. Kripal joins me right after this to talk about them. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Jeffrey Kripal holds the J. Newton Razor Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University, where he's also the chairman of the Department of Religious Studies. He is the author of Authors of the Impossible, The Paranormal and the Sacred, Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, and other books. He's currently working on a book on the paranormal and American popular culture and is one of my favorite guests tonight here to talk about his newest work, Comparing Religions. Jeffrey, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me, George. It's a pleasure.
I am not sure we've ever explored a book like this on this program, and it's I don't want to scare people, but I want to say it. It's a textbook. It's written for a college classroom. I don't want to scare people into thinking it's a dry like a textbook at all, because it reads like a paranormal bestseller for smart people.
Yeah, well, it truly is a textbook. I wrote it after teaching for about 20 years, an introductory course on how to think about religion comparatively. But I didn't want to write a typical textbook. I wanted to write something that, you know, interested anyone can pick up and get something out of.
Well, that's for sure. It's getting rave reviews, as I'm sure you know. One reviewer called it exceptional, and she says, this book is the red pill. Ingest it, and you will be enlightened. Is that what you're going for?
Well, sort of, yeah. Actually, yeah.
Is it actually being used in classrooms? Are you using it?
Absolutely. It was just published last April, and of course, academic cycles didn't allow it to be used last spring because, of course, all the courses would have been, you know, half over when it came out. So the first time it'll really be used is now, this fall semester. So I'm using it here at Rice. I teach this course, and I have about 250 students in this particular class each fall. So, yes.
Is there a sort of a cadre of these radical religious studies professor who think like you do, who are going to get this insidious book in college classrooms?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I'm of the position that the professional study of religion, it has been doing this kind of work for many decades. It's not a couple of centuries now, and I wanted to tell that story and kind of get people excited about what we do and convince them that we're not just, you know, eggheads in the ivory tower. We're actually doing really interesting work, and here's what it looks like, you know.
You make the point in the book that the college students who think of religious studies, they think, oh, that sounds soft and easy. I'll take that as an elective. You think it's not easy, and it's the hard sciences that have it easy. Tell me that.
Right. So my colleagues in the sciences, whom of course I admire, I would suggest they do the easy stuff in the sense that, you know, they work with things that we can really know about and we can really measure, and for the most part don't really challenge people's deepest values and worldview. You know, when you study algebra, you don't have an existential crisis, or when you study organic chemistry if you studied astronomy or evolutionary biology, you might. But for the most part, you know, in the sciences, you're studying things that are well established and can be shown convincingly. Whereas in the humanities, and particularly the study of religion, what you're really doing is respectfully playing with people's worldviews and deepest deepest values and beliefs, and demonstrating in many cases that those beliefs and values have histories and that they're not absolute and that they've changed over time and they'll change again. And that can be very that can be very scary, but it can also be very liberating, depending on the, you know, the set, as it were, of the person encountering that. So I think what we do in the humanities is that actually the really tough stuff, and what's done in the sciences is, in some sense, much easier.
I know that you have stirred the pot with previous books. You're already stirring it with this book, and you seem to delight in that. I know these hard science guys obviously don't like your stuff, but I also know a lot of them, they don't think psychiatry is a science. So, of course, they don't like humanities, literature. I'm sure they probably think that shouldn't even be taught, let alone religious studies. You must get that even at Rice University. How did we let this guy in?
Well, you know, scientists are human beings too. And, you know, some of them do feel that way, I'm sure. But I think most of them actually don't feel that way. And I've been talking about these ideas for about a decade or so now, the really weird stuff. And I actually find a lot of support for it among my colleagues. And the general response is, hey, we know this stuff happens. We know it's real. We don't really know what to do with it. And I'm really happy you're talking about it, which I translate as, and I'm really happy that I'm not talking about it. In other words, you talk about it, Jeff. I don't know what to do with it. So that's what I do. You know, that's my job.
It occurred to me as I'm reading this that while you probably do get, I know you get grief because I read some of the reactions to something you wrote earlier this year that we'll talk about a little bit later, Mark Twain in particular. And I know you get some grief from the hard science guys who think it's all a little foo-foo for them. But it occurred to me as I'm reading your book that you must get it from religions, too, who don't want you talking about the kind of weird things that we're going to get into tonight, and explaining that them away as anything other than an act of God. That was right there. That was Yahweh. That was Muhammad doing this stuff. That was Buddha. It wasn't some UFO or something otherwise outside the realm of spiritual beliefs. You get it from both sides.
Right. Yeah. We get whacked from both ends. the study of religion is a liminal enterprise. You know, we're certainly calling into question the scientific materialism that runs the culture now, or at least some of us call into question that. But we're also calling into question the absolute claims and authority of the religious traditions. But we're also trying to be respectful of both. We're trying to look both ways and kind of cut a middle path through the two. But as a result, we sometimes get into trouble on both ends of the spectrum, as it were.
Yeah, I mean,
on the other hand, we get fans on both ends of the spectrum. I mean, the truth is when you say, I mean, the truth is that an intellectual is here to provoke people. That's, I think, what intellectuals do at their very best. That's what we're here for. But when you do that, of course, you provoke some people and you delight others, and you just have to accept that as the process.
I'm reluctant to use this word, but I will just for purposes of discussion. It is hard to put your cosmology into a couple of words or sentences, but it's fair to say it's pretty broad. I mean, you cast a wide net, cover a lot of stuff that most comparative religion writers and teachers, I would think, would never touch. UFOs, the paranormal and supernatural, monsters, comic book superheroes. You throw a wide net out there.
Right. So that's all in Chapter 8. So the book covers all of the traditional stuff that scholars of religion cover, myth and ritual and social institutions and sex and gender and doctrine, belief, on and on, and all the stuff that you'd expect to get in a course. But I also wanted to put on the table stuff that we normally don't talk about, but that I think we should. And so Chapter 8 is all about the religious imagination and the paranormal. And that's where, you know, that's where the UFOs come spinning in and the Mothman appears. So, I did that very intentionally, to try to broaden the discussion and also, frankly, reach 18-year-olds. 18-year-olds like the Mothman. They like flying saucers. And we can think with those things in very, very constructive ways.
Yeah, teaching tool. Near the beginning of the book, you write about the ancient Greeks who would kind of send out a scout of sorts. I think you called it state pilgrimage, someone who would go out and learn about other religions and then come back and report his findings, sort of like what you're doing.
Right. I mean, this is where we actually get the Greek word theory, which literally means a vision, as in a vision trip. So what the Greeks would do is they would send somebody out to another country or to a foreign city. They would leave, they would go, they would witness these spectacles in this foreign city, usually religious spectacles, and then they would come back to Greece and report what they saw. And of course, what they saw often changed their view of the world. And my suggestion is this is exactly how the study of religion, of comparative religion, works. It's theory in that sense. You leave your own world, at least in your mind, and you go visit foreign worlds and you see spectacles, and then you come back to your own world, wherever that is, and hopefully you're changed in some humble or more profound way.
I remember using a phrase one time about a saying based on what the Irish, an old Irish saying, a place where the world is thin, where they point to places where it seems like the line between reality and the supernatural is kind of thin. But you have a phrase in your book, a gap between the ordered worlds. Sort of the same thing, I wonder?
A bit, yeah. I mean, one of the things what happens to people when they compare religions rigorously and stick with it is that they recognize that their own worlds are filled with these gaps, that things really don't fit together like they assume they did. And you can see this very easily when you leave your world and then look back on it from outside, as it were. And of course, what the sacred or what religious experience is historically, is something appearing in these gaps, is something intervening in the normal world of a community or of an individual and shaking the community or individual and causing them to change how they think about it. So, yeah, religion is all about gaps. It's all about disjunction. It's all about inbreaking.
I remember reading something about an earlier work of yours that maybe we talked about it the last time you were here, that the Hindu fundamentalists wanted to hunt you down and flog you or worse. And I'm trying to remember what it is that you wrote that enraged them so much. But it occurred to me that, I don't know, maybe some of your academic colleagues also don't want to tolerate discussions. You say that some of them encourage you behind the scenes that, yeah, go ahead. Attaboy, go get them. But it seems like hard scientists, at least the ones that we encounter dealing with on this program, don't want to deal with extraordinary events and experiences. They can't measure them, and they don't want to be bothered with it.
Yeah, those, of course, are two different issues. I mean, the early part of the book, Comparing Religions, I tell the story of how the study of religion came to be in the modern West, and that's about a 400-year story. And one of the things I show in that history is that whenever there was an advance in the critical study of religion, particularly it all started with the critical study of the Bible, is that these scholars were inevitably imprisoned, they lost their jobs, their books were burned, and so there's this constant pushback against the study of religion historically. And my early work on erotic mysticism or erotic mystical literature in India was an example of that, that the pushback occurred in the late 1990s. But I was one of just a dozen or so, actually, scholars of Hinduism over about a two-decade period that were harassed and censored by these same fundamentalists. So this is what scholars of religion have to deal with. And it's not just in the study of Hinduism, it's the study of Islam, the study of Christianity, the study of Sikhism. I mean, you can name almost any field and you will find harassed and censored scholars. And this is why I say again, hey, look, guys, we're the ones doing the really tough stuff. Nobody's banning your chemistry textbook, but they're banning our book.
You use a lot of different terms, not always interchangeably, but they're related in a way. Supernatural, paranormal, extraordinary events, sacred, spiritual. I mean, you look at them in a certain spectrum and they all kind of look like they belong together. I mean, are you saying there is a link?
Well, there's clearly a link. All of those terms actually mean very different things, and they have different histories, and we can talk about those differences tonight if you want. But they all have very different nuances. They appeared at different points in time, and we can be very precise about what they mean. That's why the subtitle to my textbook is called Coming to Terms. That's meant in two senses, coming to emotional terms with the study of religion, but also actually literally coming to terms, understanding where these terms come from and how to use them very precisely. So yes, they're all different. On the other hand, they're all similar. And this is the basic insight of the whole textbook. The comparative act is to recognize similarity, but to also recognize difference in religious experiences and expressions.
A lot of it boils down to, and I don't want to jump too far ahead or to overly simplify, but it boils down to consciousness, doesn't it? I mean, different manifestations of the same thing, some form of consciousness. There's a quote you have in the book that I thought was tremendous. It's your line. You say that we are in a fantastically ridiculous situation where conscious individuals are telling us that consciousness doesn't really exist as such. If this were not so absurd, it would be funny.
Right. And, I do sort of land at the end of the book on the nature of consciousness as the big, big question that religion poses. But that's chapter 12. That's the last book. So we did, in fact, jump ahead there. But, yeah, I do think that's what it's all about. And, of course, every religious experience that we know of occurred in the consciousness of some human being. So whatever religion is, whatever else it is, or it may be or may not be, it's clearly about human consciousness. That I think we can say with absolute certainty.
I'm not sure, we got about 2 minutes before the break, so I'm not sure we have enough time to tell the first Mark Twain story, but I think it's a good illustration, though. We can at least start with it. Mark Twain sort of had some experiences that helped set a framework for what you talk about in the key chapter, chapter 8 in the book. Tell us the first one, I guess.
The first Mark Twain story?
Yeah, I think the vision he had.
So the Twain story, Twain actually had a number of paranormal experiences that he didn't call them paranormal because the word didn't exist, but his whole life was riddled with these. And one of the most poignant ones was he had a very clear dream one night of his brother Henry in a casket, a metal casket, on two chairs with a bouquet of roses, with a white rose sort of in the middle. It might have been reversed. And the dream was so real, when he woke up, he was going to walk to the dead room. He thought his brother was dead, but his brother wasn't dead. But the next day, the brothers were separated, and about 2-3 weeks later, Henry was seriously wounded in a boiler explosion on a riverboat and then given an overdose of opium by an inexperienced doctor and died. So Twain went, of course, to the funeral, and when he arrived at the dead room, there was the exact details of his dream played out right before his eyes. Everything was perfect except for the bouquet of flowers. And as he watched, a woman walked in with that exact bouquet of flowers, laid it on Henry's chest. So Twain was absolutely convinced that he had seen his brother's funeral, 2 or 3 weeks into the future and a couple hundred miles away. And, he had no doubt about that. He called it mental telegraphy. The paranormal experiences are always modeled on the cutting technology of the time, and the cutting technology of that time was the telegraph. So Twain called it mental telegraphy.
That wasn't too. Yeah, that was pretty sharp. I want to talk more about how he processed that event and the other experiences he had. Jeff Kripal is our guest, talking about the comparing religions and religious experiences. Right after this, much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Depeche Mode, with its own view of religion, suggesting that it's a personal experience, not necessarily a collective experience. So I want to remind you that we're conducting a poll tonight about reviews on alien abductions, alleged alien abductions, what you think the explanation for that might be. If you want to chime in, it's on the Coast to Coast website. You can give us your thoughts on what might be behind that reported phenomena, one we've discussed on this program many times. We delve into the world of UFOs and those kinds of experiences with my guest, Jeff Kripal, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff, before the break, you told us a story about Mark Twain, famous writer, who had a vision of sorts about his brother's death, and then a few weeks later, that very vision sort of came into being, and I'm curious about how he processed that. I know when the article first came out some months ago, and you wrote about it prior to the book, that you got criticism for, well, people said Mark Twain was known to be an exaggerator of considerable proportions, so maybe he was just exaggerating. Do you have any indication of how he processed this and how seriously he took it?
Well, he definitely was not exaggerating, and he took it very, very seriously. I mean, he was a storyteller and a great humorist, and was famous for, of course, debunking anything and everything, but he wasn't debunking this. What actually happened with Twain is that these experiences were very common in his life. And he connected them actually to his own literary creativity. He believed that a lot of the ideas that he got for his books and short stories essentially came out of the ether. That's my expression, not his. That he got ideas from other people through this mental telegraphy in a kind of unconscious way. And he thought about these things for really most of his adult life and tried to write about them, but was afraid to. He was afraid to publish them because people would make fun of them, essentially. And what the first thing he tried was he wrote an essay called Mental Telegraphy, and he submitted it to Harper's Magazine on the condition that they publish it anonymously. Well, of course, if you're a publisher and one of the most famous authors in the land gives you something and then says, oh, by the way, you can't use my name, you're not going to do it. So they refused, and he eventually decided to publish it under his own name. And then he published another one called Mental Telegraphy again a few years later. And if you read those two essays, this man was very serious. He was not exaggerating. He was struggling, like any reasonable person, with these kinds of anomalous cognitions. And he took them very, very seriously. And as I demonstrate both in the textbook and in that essay last spring in the Chronicle of Higher Education, Twain's not alone among serious people. I mean, scientists have these experiences, philosophers have them, medical professionals have them all the time. It's simply not true that they're super rare or that only people who are naive or something have these experiences. That's simply not true.
Yeah, really creative people seem to have that a lot. It's like a Tom Petty, as a songwriter, he says, it's almost like you crank up your antenna and then see what comes in. Or I spoke earlier in the program about seeing Paul McCartney. McCartney and Lennon went through this incredibly creative period where they would just sort of focus. And it was almost like trance or spell or dream state when you connect with the Akashic record or the cosmos or something, and this stuff comes beaming into your head.
Well, you know, George, the last time I appeared on your show, it was for the Mutants and Mystics book, and that was the whole premise of that book, is that artists and authors who create popular culture have inevitably had these sorts of experiences, and they link them to their own sort of creative energies, and it's how they make art. It's how they write books. So, absolutely. And I think this has everything to do with religion again. I think historically, you know, people didn't write comic books or science fiction novels. They invented new religions. Now, of course, we don't do that today as much, although people do that, but they're clearly related processes. There's no question in my mind about it.
You use a phrase that Twain had used, crossed correspondence, to sort of describe something else that he experienced more than once.
Right. So cross correspondences, the plural was Twain's expression. I think he actually got it from the psychical research tradition in London and the UK. But what it referred to was you would suddenly think of an old friend or family member out of the blue, and you'd sit down to write a letter, and you'd put the letter in the mail, and the next day a letter from that person would appear. So the belief was that there was some kind of, unconscious connection between two people at a great distance. And Twain experienced this on multiple occasions and again wrote about it in these mental telegraphy essays and linked it again to his own literary life.
In this chapter 8, which is sort of the heart of the book as far as this program is concerned, you get into some pretty strange stuff. As we mentioned, not strange to us, but it might be strange to other academics. It starts off with sort of a quote from Terence McKenna that kind of sets a tone in which he says, "We are part of a symbiotic relationship with something which disguises itself as an extraterrestrial invasion so as not to alarm us." Raises a pretty interesting prospect that, what we now consider to be extraterrestrials has been considered, it could be considered something else down the line, just as you've reported before, Jacques Vallée and others have said, it was perceived as something else in ages before.
Right. And remember, the whole textbook, the premise of the whole textbook is that we are all comparing all the time. And by comparing, I mean we are all taking different things in our experience and we're trying to figure out how they're similar and how they're different. And when we come to a comparative conclusion, we always come to that conclusion by identifying some basis or foundation through which this thing over here and this thing over here can be compared. So if we're comparing an A and a B, we're always going to find a C through which A and B is connected. And so the UFO thing is a perfect example of that. I mean, people who want to say that ancient religions were really ancient astronauts are comparing, but their sea is the present. It's kind of this science fiction imagination of the extraterrestrial, the flying saucer. But you can easily turn that on its head and say, well, maybe, but it's just as likely that modern UFO encounters are actually ancient gods, right? Because there you're privileging the ancient religious worldview and you're doing the comparison. So what I'm trying to do in the textbook isn't land on one of those, isn't kind of declare which one's true, but just point out to people that we're always comparing and we're always assuming some worldview that we think is true and that we can then read the past through or read the present through. But we have to be very careful about that because, of course, that's what ancient people did and they came to different conclusions. And that's what our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will do, and they'll come to different conclusions again. So we have to be very, I think, humble about that act.
You make the point that light forms are a global constant in the history of religions. And you quoted about Mark Fox's study, I guess, tracking 400 unpublished accounts from a large database, pointing out that these kinds of things that we would call UFOs have been around a heck of a long time and are often sort of incorporated into what others would call religious experiences and appear at times of emotional crisis, right?
Right, right, right. The Fox book is about these, what he calls light forms and what I call conscious balls of light, which are everywhere in the history of religion. The soul or the spirit in ancient Greek philosophy and religion, something we call Neoplatonism, was said to be a perfect sphere or a ball of light. And you see the same kind of thing in Jainism, which is an ancient Indian religion, that the liberated soul is a perfect sphere of light. these things have been around a long time, and people do encounter these things.
they encounter conscious balls of light. I referenced an anthropologist in Latin America whose party was tracked by these things for a while. And again, it just depends on what the local explanation is. Sometimes they're UFOs, sometimes they're dead ancestors, sometimes they're witches, you know, and they can be any number of things depending on the cultural framework.
Poltergeist, you mentioned, angry ghost. I guess French scientists who studied them were called it, I guess, this the term being angry ghost, but they chose, you say they chose the word paranormal, beyond the normal, as a replacement for the word supernatural. Why was paranormal better than supernatural for these guys?
Right. So remember earlier in the first half hour, I made this point that these terms are all related, but they're all very different. And this is a perfect example of that. So historically, what the supernatural meant in the Christian West was essentially something that comes from God or the devil. It can actually be either. But that it's not part of the natural world. It comes from above. That's what super means, above. So the supernatural is something that intervenes in the natural order of things, but is not part of the natural order of things. Now, by the time you get to the late 19th century and the turn of the 20th century, you know, science has taken hold, and these researchers had more or less abandoned this idea that there was this supernatural realm. They felt that these experiences were real, but that they probably had natural explanations that we just didn't know about yet. And that's why they coined the term paranormal. What they meant by it was these things are normal, but they're para, they're beyond our present scientific understanding. But we'll someday have that scientific model and we'll understand how they're part of the world. So for example, the poltergeist is the best example. You know, the word means is German for angry ghost. But what the researchers concluded was that in most of these cases, there was no angry ghost. There was the ghost of anger. In other words, the breaking objects or flying objects or scratches were always seemed to be happening around a focal agent. And that focal agent was usually a young person in adolescence, and was somehow troubled or in conflict, or the family network was stressed. And so they, you know, they theorized that what poltergeist phenomena are it's essentially emotional or sexual conflict or stress that somehow, through mechanisms we don't understand, being exteriorized into the environment. So they flipped the religious understanding, essentially. They were essentially arguing that this is not an angry ghost. This is essentially anger being turned into a ghost by this focal agent on an entirely unconscious level, by the way. So it was a different model of what was happening, and it was an attempt to naturalize the supernatural. And so in the textbook, what I do, the best definition I have for the paranormal is what I call the supernatural, and there's a space between those two words. I think that's the key to the whole thing. It's not supernatural, it's supernatural.
You know, I've caught myself stepping over a line, get into some conversation about UFOs, and somebody will come along and say, well, this is, you know, that these are not flying saucers or extraterrestrial, these are demons. And I'll say, oh, no, come on now. And then I stop myself and think, well, what do I know? I don't know. Maybe they are demons. For all we know, they're different manifestations of the same thing, and they appear like UFOs from another planet at one point. We assume they're from extraterrestrial origin. Or maybe they're demons and are fooling us. I mean, we really don't know.
Well, and again, see, that's a comparative practice, George. When someone says UFOs are really demons, they're engaging in comparison, and they're assuming the truth of their own particular religious worldview. And then they're imposing that worldview on this phenomenon in the environment. And I'm just as suspicious of that move as I am of, you know,
right,
or extraterrestrials or ancient astronauts. All I'm trying to do is point out, look, folks, you're all comparing, and you need to become more aware of your comparative practice, and you need to question that. And then we're not going to get to the answer here, but we're going to get closer to an answer.
Well, I want to explore that further. We're not going to get the answer here because you said a couple of minutes ago, you know, the hope being someday we'll have more info and we'll understand this. Some of these mysteries, it doesn't look like that's the case at all. It, as I mentioned, we had our earlier guest, Roger, who was talking about cases. MUFON needs more cases, more investigation, more analysis. 50 years of UFO cases, and we still don't have enough information to figure this out. It is always tantalizingly just out of our reach. Boy, if we just had a little bit more info, we could figure this out. And then it morphs into something else.
Right. Now, remember, I actually didn't say that we'd eventually figure it out. I said
No. I mean, you're quoting somebody. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Right. Those French scientists said that. That's why they coined the word paranormal.
Yes.
I'm deeply suspicious of that. I am not of the school that says, well, just give us a few more cases and science will figure this out. I actually don't think science is capable of figuring these things out because I don't think they're objects. I don't think they're material objects that can be measured and replicated and controlled in a laboratory. So it's not that I'm rejecting science. I'm just pointing out these things are not scientific objects.
What do you think about the idea that they do morph? It's the same thing, morphing into different forms or different manifestations as a way to keep us just searching for it.
I'm very attracted to that. I mean, I think there's a kind of trickster quality to this stuff. And, you know, if you remember Chapter 8, I actually begin Chapter 8 on the paranormal with a discussion of the trickster. And through George Hansen, who wrote a beautiful book on the trickster and the paranormal. And that's really my view as well. I think these things are messing with us. And I think we need to be messed with. We're too certain about things.
Well, maybe it's even bigger than that. Maybe it's messing with us. That's the whole purpose of it.
My point. I think it is. You know, and this is essentially what Carl Jung thought about flying saucers. He basically said, I don't know what these things are, but what I think they're doing is challenging our materialistic worldview. That they're here to create a kind of psychological balance and to essentially mess with.
Well, you just look at UFOs. I mean, studying the modern history of UFOs, at first they're just craft, you know, nuts and bolts craft. And then, holy cow, they've got people in them. They must be people from another planet. And then it was people up in the sky, and then they started landing and interacting, and then there's abductions. It's always sort of changing a little bit and always staying a step or two ahead.
Right. Well, you know, what I say at the first pages of the book is that the more you look at this stuff, the weirder it gets. It does not get more rational. It does not get easier. It gets weirder and weirder and weirder. And I think that's essential to the phenomenon. I think that's, again, what it's about. And of course, that's what religion is about. It's not about explaining things. It's about mystery.
And pursuing it and striving.
Right, right, right.
Well, I definitely want to. We're going to go to a break here in a second. Definitely want to jump into the whole trickster phenomena in greater detail. You're familiar with the work we did at that Utah ranch and the hunt for the Skinwalker stuff, and it seemed like that, whatever the heck that was, it was definitely messing with people's minds on purpose.
Right, and it was behaving in a way that couldn't be tracked by science and technology. I love the Skinwalker case. I mean, I talk and write about it all the time, George, because I think it's a perfect case of what I'm trying to get across about it.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that we can get to the bottom of the trickster mystery as a way of finding out what happens to my socks when I put them in the laundry and they don't come back. I mean, I'm sort of joking, but you kind of get into that about tricksters pulling that kind of that would otherwise be mundane little pranks.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking with Jeffrey Kripal. His new book, Comparing Religions, is a mind bender, as I mentioned. We'll get into tricksters and a lot more when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM.